Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How have alcoholic drinks shaped the history of humankind? It's hardly a stretch to imagine that drinking has intensified the emotions associated with friendship, love, war, and worship for thousands of years. But as my guest today will explain, we might also have alcohol to thank for the civilizing effects of the rise of agriculture and the domestication of many more crops than just grapes. Patrick E. McGovern is scientific director of the Biomolecular Archaeology Laboratory for Cuisine, Fermented Beverages, and Health at the University of Pennsylvania Museum. His latest book is called Uncorking the Past, The Quest for Wine, Beer, and Other Alcoholic Beverages. He's in town to deliver tonight's Beauchel Family Lecture at the Dallas Museum of Art. The topic will be the archaeological and chemical hunt for the origins of viniculture, and you can find ticket information online at dallasmuseumofart.org. Pat, welcome to Think.
I'm very glad to be here.
So our first taste of alcohol might have been a slurp of rotting fruit?
Rotting fruit is one possibility. Also, take any kind of wild grain or root, chew it up. You break the starches down into sugar, wait for sort of a wandering yeast to come by, and it would start, you know, and produce a beer in that case.
Mm-hmm. And we're not the only creatures that like alcohol.
No, just about every animal on this planet is attracted to alcohol and sugar. So, you know, from the lowly fruit fly right up to the elephant, they all would like to get as much sugar and alcohol as possible. Sometimes it can be quite dangerous. I mean, in the case of elephants, they can break into breweries like they've done in India and gone on rampages where they, you know, knock down houses, kill people, and so forth. But they had a good time doing it, I guess.
So are most animals able to smell alcohol and know that this is something they want to imbibe?
Right. There's like a wafting of the fumes or plumes of the alcohol that really attracts all the different animals, you know, in the vicinity. And so, you know, where, you know, they trace it back to the origin, you know, and then they find, you know, it's either fermenting fruit or, you know, maybe the liquid that's fermented into alcohol.
So talk about our first deliberate attempts to make alcohol. It's one thing to sort of find it in nature. It's another thing to have it happen on purpose.
The first deliberate attempts that we know about, and this is, you know, where my research, especially on the Neolithic period, you know, comes into play. This is like a time period. It varies in different parts of the world, but let's say 8,000 to 4,000 BC in the Middle East. And it's the period in which we're domesticating all different kinds of plants and animals. So that's the period when, you know, barley, wheat, rice in China, corn in the Americas, sorghum, millet, all the different grains and all, a whole variety of different fruits are brought into domestication or at least being cultivated. You know, like the grape, we think also probably goes back to that period as well.
Why was the Neolithic period such a great leap forward in terms of our technology?
I think the people in that period just, they got on to being very innovative, exploring their environments very intensely. And, you know, a lot of the plants and animals that we still use for our basic foods, you know, beer, bread, all the different kinds of sheep, goat, cattle, types of entrees, different herbs. They just had a way in different parts of the world, too, and occurring, you know, not at all that much different times of really just doing innovative exploratory work.
And what makes you suspect that domestication of grain actually had more to do with our desire to produce some beer than to bake some bread?
Well, because, one of the simple questions you can always ask is, you know, if you had your choice, bread or beer, which would it be?
I'd actually like a little of both, but.
there's evidence, say, for the Middle East that we don't have really bread ovens or carbonized grain appearing in the excavations until many thousands of years later than we know that wheat and barley were domesticated. The same thing in the New World. There's like a couple, three or 4,000 year divide between the domestication of corn and when you actually see isotope ratios in our bones indicating that they're consuming it as bread. Because bread, you get more protein in the case of corn.
Yeah.
And so that signature in your bones only starts to pick up showing that bread's being used maybe 3,000 years after the actual domestication. So what were they doing in the time, you know, when it was domesticated and the time when the bread was being made? Well, they were making it into a very highly nutritious drink, which has preservative properties and which also has the mind-altering effect. I mean, that is really the key to making the case that beer comes before bread.
Mm-hmm. So you come for the calories, you stay for the buzz.
Yeah.
We don't think of alcohol as being a source of nutrients at all today. Nobody ever talks about that.
Right.
Was it somehow more nutritious then, or just in comparison to what else they had to eat?
Oh, it's a case where we've gotten used to beers in this country in which all the nutrients have been taken out of it. You know, mm-hmm. So all that yeast and all the hulls and the special compounds that develop if you just have a naturally fermented beer and leave a lot of the, you know, you can filter it, of course, but if you leave enough of the basic ingredients there, you end up with actually a highly nutritious liquid bread, you could call it.
And safer in many cases than drinking water out of a nearby stream.
Oh, yeah, much, much safer. I mean, that's one of the main reasons, you know, that alcohol is so important because it, you know, if you have a choice between water taken out of a stream or wherever versus an alcoholic beverage, the alcohol kills microorganisms. Mm-hmm. So the people that drank fermented beverages generally then would live longer and also reproduce more.
Mm-hmm. Do you have evidence that there was always a set of rules about a little is good, too much is bad?
Yeah. I mean, every culture has this whole problem of deciding what is too much or when people, you know, binge or overdo it and how you control that. Now, you could do it religiously, socially. You know, sometimes you just, like in the case of the Shang Dynasty emperors who sort of drank themselves into oblivion and committed suicide and went crazy and everything else, the dynasty that follows them, you know, is very highly critical. And they claim that they're going to sort of cut back on the amount of alcohol that's being drunk. But, of course, they don't do that. They keep going because I think the whole issue is binging is sort of built into our genetics as well because if you think about it, if you've got, you know, some ripe fruit that is available and it's going to disappear if you don't, you know, really start to drink or to eat it.
Yeah.
You better indulge yourself, you know, to the greatest extreme that you can before that fruit or beverage that's been fermented disappears. So you see this like in – there's a film on YouTube called Jungle Alcohol, which shows a fig tree in which, you know, fig trees have like, you know, tens of thousands of individual fruit. Elephants in this case had knocked the tree and all these figs had fallen on the ground. And you see every kind of creature, you know, just engulfing and, you know, eating as much as they possibly can. So, you know, it's monkeys, it's snails, it's wild boar, you know, everybody's there, you know, feasting away. So that, I think, is, you know, why overindulgence maybe arose and sort of got incorporated into our DNA.
And is it wasps? Do they taste a bit of really early alcohol and then go pollinate a bunch of trees?
Yeah, the wasp is the one that, you know, each individual fig tree, like there's 10,000 species in these tropical areas around the world, they have individual wasps that do the pollination. And it's a very intricate procedure, you know, where the male, digs a hole for the female to escape, but he dies in the process and she then moves on and goes to another fig tree, and the male and the female flowers don't come into bloom at the same time. So it's a very complicated, intricate process, which, you know, shows this close symbiosis between trees, humans, other animals that goes back, 100 million years. So they're all sort of adjusting themselves to the available situation,
yeah.
And it develops, you know, over time then. And figs are very interesting because we probably the earliest domesticated fig, earliest domesticated fruit is the fig in the Jordan Valley around 10,000 BC.
Could that have been the tree of knowledge in the Garden of Eden?
You never know because, I mean, the fruit really hasn't been identified. You know, I sort of lean toward grapes because they say that in the text, at least in the Gilgamesh epic, you know, which is the Mesopotamian version of the biblical version, which comes earlier, is that the fruit is blue and red. So you sort of have like a white and a red grape.
Yeah. So let's step back for a minute here and talk about the science and how you determine what people were drinking and how and when. You work with one of the things you work with is potsherds. Is that right?
Yeah, potsherds are really good because they absorb liquids. Mm-hmm. And if you're going back as far as the Neolithic period where you have the first pottery, then you have possible samples that have absorbed, you know, different ancient organics that you can take, and you use different solvents like chloroform, methanol to extract the ancient organics. And then because in the last 40 years, all these chemical micro techniques have been developed, we can then go through a whole series, a battery of tests, you know, liquid chromatography, gas chromatography, mass spectrometry, and then pull out the compounds and then try to reconstruct what the original ingredients would have been in those vessels.
So later on, there were sort of set recipes, but initially it sounds like they would just throw anything in there that might contribute to fermentation.
Right, especially in the Neolithic period. I mean, what we discovered was anywhere you were in the world, they really just throw everything in. Because they want to be sure they have enough sugar, you know, from different resources. Some areas don't have, you know, really sugar-rich plants that they can draw upon. So they're even forced to throw, you know, more diverse kinds of ingredients in. But the idea is to get enough sugar in there that it's going to be fermentable. And then at the same time, since alcoholic beverages are also a medicine, this is another thing we've sort of become much more aware of as we've done these analyses and seen compounds that point to different herbs and tree resins and so forth. Alcohol dissolves or takes into solution the compounds that are in these different herbs and spices. And it's also very easily administered either by drinking or by applying it to your skin. And so it's sort of the ideal kind of medicine. It's the universal medicine, in a sense, before we had synthetic drugs.
Well, it makes sense, too, because obviously it dulls the senses. So if you're in pain, a drink might have helped.
Well, just like today, you know, sometimes people have backaches and the only thing that really gives them some relief is a stiff drink. And, alcohol works on sort of multiple levels. I mean, it's also a social lubricator. Mm-hmm. So it brings people together. I mean, when you have a party, if you don't, you know, drink enormous amounts, of course, you eventually go into lethargy and collapse on the floor perhaps.
But, you know, well, stop short of that.
If you keep it as moderate drinking, which has been shown to be medically the best way to use alcohol, you know, it does act as sort of a stimulant at first. So the people get, you know, excited and want to talk and they want to, get together as a group. And even historically, I mean, that's the way a lot of times leaders would make their decisions. Like the ancient Persians, you'd have a whole group of the king and all of his attendants and so forth and, you know, higher officials that would get together and drink the night before to try to resolve some crucial issue. And then the next morning when they were sober, they would go back over the discussion. Because in the evening, I mean, they are able to, you know, be open and share their ideas and debate it a little bit more freely.
They're feeling inspired.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the next morning when they're more sober, if they come to the same decision, then they would say, you know, that's fine. That's what we're going to do.
Patrick E. McGovern is my guest. He is Scientific Director of the Biomolecular Archaeology Laboratory for Cuisine, Fermented Beverages, and Health at the University of Pennsylvania Museum. His latest book is called Uncorking the Past, The Quest for Wine, Beer, and Other Alcoholic Beverages. He's in town to speak tonight at the Dallas Museum of Art for the Boeschel Family Lecture. The topic is the archaeological and chemical hunt for the origins of viniculture. You can find ticket information online at dallasmuseumofart.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call now at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Patrick E. McGovern. His most recent book is called Uncorking the Past, The Quest for Wine, Beer, and Other Alcoholic Beverages. He's in town to deliver tonight's Beauchelle Family Lecture at the Dallas Museum of Art on the archaeological and chemical hunt for the origins of viniculture. Join our conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Chemically speaking, Pat, what is alcohol?
It's just a very simple alcohol. It's ethyl alcohol. So it's like CH3CH2OH.
And what is fermentation?
Fermentation is when yeast consume sugar and excrete alcohol and carbon dioxide.
And it happens naturally without our intervention
right.
in some places.
Yeah, it's a natural process which is probably the earliest source of energy production on the planet.
Are our bodies evolved to respond to alcohol? Because we live for a very long time without apparently consuming it in great amounts.
Yes. I mean, our livers have about 10% of the alcohol dehydrogenase enzyme, which breaks alcohol down into energy. So 10% of our functioning livers are set up to take care of all the alcohol we might take in and also get rid of any bad byproducts like acetaldehyde too. And some cultures, like the Chinese culture, they get a flushing reaction when they drink like the slightest amount of alcohol because they lack the enzyme that breaks the aldehyde down, acetaldehyde down. And it's a poisonous substance that causes your face to get very red.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably like a protective genetic device to keep people from over-drinking.
But in fact, they may have been the first ones to make wine?
Well, according to our current evidence, the earliest alcoholic beverage does come from China. It caught me by surprise too, but I was fortunate enough to go to China and they still have a very strong drinking culture despite this flushing reaction. And you spend a lot of time toasting at dinners and what have you. And they really wanted me to pursue research on ancient beverages. And we got some samples from a Neolithic site in the Yellow River Valley dated about 7,000 BC. And that turned out to be, so far, the earliest alcoholic beverage that we've identified chemically.
Have you been able to reproduce the formulas for some of these early drinks that you suspect they may have been made? And I'm curious as to what this stuff tasted like. Was it awful?
Yeah, well, that's what I, when they first, came up with some of these weird concoctions. Like we have one that based on a tomb in central Turkey, which was really the first one that we did, that's thought to be the tomb of King Midas or his father Gordius, in which we had a mixture. The final recipe we came up, according to the chemical evidence, was a mixture of wine, beer, and mead. And we thought,
sounds like a bad frat party.
Yeah. I mean, how in the world could you make something, mixed together wine and beer? So we had a competition between microbrewers to come up with possible drinkable concoctions, which we would also, test some of the parameters of how it could be made and also produce some of this. And we used to, at the University of Pennsylvania Museum, we would have Michael Jackson come every year. Now, this is not the entertainer,
singer, right?
But the writer about beer and scotch. He would come and have it. There was a dinner before the tasting on Saturday. Friday night, we'd have the dinner, and all these microbrewers were there. And I just got up and explained this weird concoction that we'd come up with for the Midas beverage. And if anybody would be interested, they could come to my laboratory the next morning at 9 a.m., and I would explain a little bit more. And next morning, like 25 brewers showed up, and they went back and started sending me some of their experimental brews. And my job was to taste them. They would arrive at my front door, and then I would have to do the tasting and see if any of them were, worthy of being reproduced.
And Dogfish Head was the winner?
And Dogfish Head turned out to be the winner. And that led on to Midas Touch, which is the most awarded beer of Dogfish Head, and Dogfish Head is the fastest growing microbrewery in the country right now. So it's very gratifying to see how, that has all developed in the last 10 years.
So King Midas was on to something.
Yeah, he definitely had the golden touch.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go to the phones now. First off is Jessica in Denton. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to talk about, in my botany class, we watched Botany of Desire, and I thought it was interesting because it talks about how Johnny Appleseed, actually, the trees that he was planting weren't edible apples, so it was really just hard cider that it was used for. And I had never heard that until I watched this movie, and I just wanted to see if you could maybe discuss this a little bit. I thought that was very interesting.
Well, apples are an important fermentable fruit, you know, probably originating in Central Asia and then moving across into Europe, and especially in Northern Europe where you didn't have grapes growing that easily. Apples, you know, figured very importantly in the drinks that were, you know, the fermented drinks that were made. And then it, you know, came to the New World subsequently. So, yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't realized that you couldn't actually eat. So there, here again, you know, there's other purposes to these fruits, especially fermented beverages that people are after.
And the yeast would have just been blowing around in nature and sort of found its way into the mash?
The yeast, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, is especially attract. Well, it's in nature. It's all over the world, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, and it probably goes back, you know, to some of the early microorganisms on this planet, and it's just developed, you know, subsequently and had these symbiotic relationships with trees and fruit and humans and other animals. But it, if you get any kind of fruit, especially that has its skin broken, insects will be attracted to that, and they carry the Saccharomyces yeast, and it gets transferred, you know, to the fruit. So then once you make the fruit into a liquid, that yeast is alive and ready to go to work on the sugar. The same with honey.
Mm-hmm.
If you dilute honey down by 10 to 1, you know, one part honey to 10 part water, there's yeast that can survive in very high sugar concentrations, and they go to work and they will ferment it naturally into mead. So that's another, you know, possible early resource that humans would have observed. You know, you could have a beehive in an old rotten tree that falls over and it rains and fills up with water, and these yeast go to work and convert it into mead, and along comes our primitive ancestor and has a taste of this, gets the mind-altering effect, and, you know, the rest is history.
Would the time it takes for this process to be complete also have been an incentive for people not to wander quite so much?
Well, with grains, that's the case. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think with anything like orchards too. I mean, if you have something that's potentially fermentable, you want to stay around, especially grains, mm-hmm. and take care of the fields and plant and do all the work that's really required to keep and produce as much as possible.
Yeah.
I mean, what you want to do is mass produce the grain so you can mass produce the alcohol.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Rollins in Dallas. Hey, Rollins.
Hi. Well, I almost called in on the earlier show because it was about health, and this is really an interesting hour you've got going there. I'm really fascinated by the culture of drinking and the whole history of it, so this is very interesting to me. But I just wanted to make a comment and then get your reaction to this, that in my lifetime I've watched the definition of what's considered normal drinking just completely transform. I mean, when I was growing up, people would have a glass of wine socially maybe a couple of times a month, and now when I ask friends what they consider moderate drinking, they say half a bottle of wine or four beers or a couple of highballs, which mm-hmm. are really double highballs. So my take lately is I've come to think that maybe people grade drinking on the curve system. As long as they know someone that drinks more than they don't drink too much.
Uh-huh.
I'm just kind of curious about your feedback on that. Otherwise, it's a great hour, and I love it.
Oh, okay, thank you. Depending on the culture and, you know, the religious stigma that might be attached to drinking especially, people adapt to that. They have social pressure, you know, and the definition of what's too much, you know, can change very dramatically, I think, in a short time, you know, one way or the other, depending on, you know, how things are defined within the society. So, you know, it's just like the clothes we wear or whatever, you know, all sorts of behavior is very much socially controlled.
Is it possible to know whether our ancient ancestors allowed their children to drink alcohol?
Well, if we look at modern ethnic groups, you know, around the world, you get some ideas, I guess, about, you know, what children might have been allowed to drink. And so in most, like in Africa, where you have like the whole continent basically is awash in different kinds of beers, the societies generally allow children to drink some. Or even if you go to Germany, you know, they have a low-alcohol beer that's still considered, you know, all right for infants and, you know, has nutritious value. So you would, you know, have infants or, you know, young children still drinking it. There's, you know, a lot of different coming-of-age ceremonies mm-hmm. and so on where, like, the Maasai in Kenya, you know, if you're 12 years old and you're being circumcised, you might be allowed to drink a little bit of mead plus blood. And then as you get older, you're allowed to drink much more mead. And so by the time you're an elder, then you're expected to just sort of, you know, drink as much as you possibly want. And you're allowed to do it, too.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. The email address is think@kera.org. We have an email here from Marty who asks, if you could talk about the role that alcoholic beverages have played in the development of complex societies, especially in the feasting that was used to form political alliances and reciprocal relationships at the heart of early political systems.
Well, I think this is really the basic issue. You know, when you talk about beer in Mesopotamia or Egypt, and those are countries that are well adapted to producing lots of barley and wheat because they're lowlands, you can have irrigation systems and so forth. But as you produce, mass produce lots of beer, you can then, you know, have more and more specialization, and people get paid actually in bread and beer. So like the pyramids would probably not have been made if it hadn't been for having lots of beer.
That was the currency.
That was what every worker who was working, I mean, we have, you know, records to this effect that they were given like a daily allotment of 5 or 6 liters of beer.
And,
yeah, and you could imagine, and they've excavated right close to the pyramids, the workman's village where the breweries are located and the bakeries are located. But, you know, imagine yourself, you know, after a hard day's work, you know, putting up these multi-ton stones to build the pyramids, you know, if you didn't have beer, you might be a little unhappy at the end of that day. You know, it's just like archaeologists. Once we were working in Jordan, and the local conservatives decided they're going to close down the only brewery in the country, which was run by Heineken. So all the archaeologists jumped in their trucks immediately, drove over to stocked up, and just filled their trucks up with as much as they could before it was completely shut down.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Gary in Plano. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Chris. Great show today.
Thanks.
Mr. McGovern, I'd like to ask you a hypothetical question, if I might, and see how you'd answer it, okay?
Sure.
If you had a teenager come to you, maybe a 14 or 15-year-old, and this person said something like, Mr. McGovern, I have never tasted alcohol ever. And I'm aware that with the hereditary issues, and I don't know what my family history is, I just can't decide whether I should ever taste, drink alcohol or not, because I believe that the only cure for alcoholism is to never take a drink.
Mm.
So what would you, with all you know about alcohol, what would you advise that young person? Would you advise them to not take a drink, or would you advise them to, what would you say?
Well, they looked at their family history to see how many people were alcoholic. That would be one consideration, I think. You have to, I think, weigh the pros and the cons. I mean, if there definitely seems to be, you know, history of alcoholism in the family, you might advise them not to really take a chance. But on the other hand, if you want, especially in Europe, you see this where alcoholic beverages are incorporated into the social life, you know, at a very young age. Like I first traveled to Germany, and I was only 16 years old. Of course, I'd never had alcoholic beverage. Maybe I had a little creme de menthe, you know, that my parents had, had in their cupboard, but basically I hadn't had any. And then I found out that beer was less expensive than Coca-Cola, so we started drinking beer. Now, you know, for me it was never a problem, and you know, it really made, you know, for some pretty nice times. Like I lived on a farm in southern Germany where they would put the beer plus lemonade into a large mug and then would pass it around to everybody at the table, including, you know, very young children. So it gets incorporated into the social fabric from a young age, and people learn how to control it a lot better. In the United States and Northern Europe, where alcohol isn't really introduced in that way, people are much more likely to binge and then have problems with alcohol.
Can you talk about some of the specialized containers that you've seen that, people clearly used to store their alcohol?
Generally, a container, a pottery container or a bronze vessel, it'll be a jug or a jar that has very narrow mouth, neck to it, so that you can put a stopper into it. And the stopper would not necessarily be cork because that comes much later. But they would use they take clay, you know, make a stopper out of that. And it functions very similarly to cork, especially if you store the wine or whatever fermented beverage it is on its side. That clay will expand as liquid is absorbed into it and seal it off better. And the Chinese were very proficient when it came to bronze vessels of putting very tight lids on their vessels. And then in some of the tombs from the Shang Dynasty about 3,000 years ago, you open up the tomb and there might be 80 vessels in there that have these lids on them, and you start shaking them and there's still actual liquid preserved
wow.
after 3,000 years. So those have been like a bonanza for us in terms of figuring out, you know, the different herbs that were added to the, in this case, it would be millet and rice wine.
How do you decide which ones to open and which ones to save for the future, or what kind of choices do you make at that point?
In terms of?
If you found, you know, several vessels of liquid, do you open them all right away, or do you sort of put some in storage for later?
Well, you probably should put something in storage. I mean, that's always a very good idea in archaeology.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you want to reserve something for future analyses, too. And, you know, that's a question you have to – each archaeologist really has to work with the scientists to try to figure out what to do.
My guest this hour is Patrick McGovern. He is Scientific Director of the Biomolecular Archaeology Laboratory for Cuisine, Fermented Beverages, and Health at the University of Pennsylvania Museum. His most recent book is called Uncorking the Past, The Quest for Wine, Beer, and Other Alcoholic Beverages. He's in town to deliver tonight's Beauchel Family Lecture at the Dallas Museum of Art. You can find ticket information at dallasmuseumofart.org. Join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Patrick E. McGovern. He is Scientific Director of the Biomolecular Archaeology Laboratory for Cuisine, Fermented Beverages, and Health at the University of Pennsylvania Museum. By the way, I don't know how you fit that on a business card.
No, that's pretty long.
His most recent book is called Uncorking the Past, and he's in town to deliver a lecture tonight at the DMA on the archaeological and chemical hunt for the origins of viniculture. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Pat, what do we know about the transition from people producing alcohol for their own consumption or their family's consumption and then the professionalization of fermenting and brewing?
Well, I think in the Neolithic or even earlier in the Paleolithic periods, it would have been much more democratic, you know, where it was shared among the whole community. But then as you get more complexity, we had that question before about, you know, how complex societies figure into this. And, you know, once you start to get mass production of grains, you have enough food to support lots of different specialists. And among those specialists are going to be the people that make solely one beverage or another. So it could be a winemaker, it could be a beer maker, mead maker, and what have you. And just get, you know, more and more definition of the roles of people within that society.
I thought it was really interesting that we know that the Egyptians loved their wine, but initially they had to import it before they learned to make it for themselves.
Right. I mean, the earliest evidence we have from a tomb – well, the first point to make is that the grapevine does not grow in Egypt. The wild grapevine did not grow in Egypt. So they had to import. And it was the pharaohs at the earliest stage in the development of Egyptian history, Dynasty Zero, around 3150 BC, where there was a king named Scorpion the First who had to import his wine from the Jordan Valley in that area. And he put 700 jars or about 4,500 liters of wine. Well, he didn't, but you know, after his death, it was put into his tomb, along with beer containers filled with beer, bread, and so forth, clothes, furniture, and what have you. You know, so you'd have a successful trip into the afterlife. But those 4,500 liters of wine had to be imported from the Jordan Valley, about 400 or 500 kilometers down to Abydos in Egypt. At 3150 BC. So we sort of surmised they used donkeys in the initial part, and then mm-hmm. they probably transferred it over to boats. And
so it would have been really expensive initially.
It would have been extremely expensive. I mean, you're talking about a rare commodity, you know, for Egypt. You know, later the pharaohs get smart and they bring in some foreign winemakers from the Levant who transplant the grapevine in the Egyptian Nile Delta, and they have a royal winemaking industry that's established around 3000 BC. But before that, you know, it was only the upper class, the elite, the kings that really could afford to. It's very much like we have today. You know, if you want to show off to your friends, this is called elite emulation. Mm-hmm. You get out that really fancy bottle of Petrus, you know, that might cost, who knows, $15,000 a bottle.
Was it a no-brainer that wine became the premier fruit that was, that grapes rather became the premier fruit for fermenting into wine?
Again, this depends on what part of the world you're in. Mm-hmm. If you're in the highland areas of the Middle East, grapes grow very well. It's the world center of the grape. The greatest genetic diversity occurs up in the Caucasus, eastern Taurus Mountains, the Zagros Mountains. So, you know, people focused on those grapes, and they were very successful in domesticating the grape. The only species of grape that we know of that was ever domesticated by humans, and there's maybe 10,000 species, but the only one that was domesticated is the Eurasian grape, which is called Vitis vinifera. And that has given us thousands of different varietals, white, red varietals with all different kinds of tastes. You know, so Cabernet, Sauvignon Blanc, all these ultimately derive from that domestication process mm-hmm. of that one grape species. 99% of the wine that is consumed in the world, you know, comes from that one species.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go back to the phones. This time we'll speak to Mark in Salina. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. When I was growing up in the UK, pubs were quite a big thing out in the Salar, you know. And there was a pub down the road from us. It was called the New Inn. But it was built in the 17th century, and I was real curious about it. My father told me, oh, wow, the New Inn. In about 1701, there was a royal proclamation that people could open up bars mm-hmm. and the new inn law to sell beer. And there mm-hmm. were two types of beer they used to sell. One was small beer and one was quite strong. Mm-hmm. And I wonder whether that was true and whether it was true that pretty well everybody drank beer because it's too dangerous to drink the water.
Well, yeah, that's what we were saying originally, is that it's much safer to drink an alcoholic beverage than water. And even armies, you know, of the ancient world, I mean, they realized that, so they would have to stock up on alcoholic beverage because you never knew if you drank the water whether the whole army might not come down with some kind of, you know, malaria, some sort of sickness. Who knows? But there's all different sort of specialty. If you look in the records, say, of Mesopotamia or Egypt, there's all different kinds of beers that were produced. It was, you know, shared by the whole population. It was the most common funerary offering to put into a tomb for, you know, for every level of society. But then there would be, you know, different specialty ambers and filtered beers, beer for eternity.
For eternity.
Yes. You know, very special one. Or maybe not so special because nobody's going to be able to really to taste it. There was enema beers. There's all sorts of things because, you know, the Egyptians were very focused on the digestive tract, the way that you sort of clean out things and keep healthy.
Would the taste of these things be recognizable to us today?
Oh, yeah. I mean, because essentially the same process is used today as is used in antiquity. So except for these sort of extreme beverages that we've been detecting in the Neolithic period and later too, they would be very similar to, you know, what we're used to today. I mean, the same process is followed of how you you change the carbohydrates, in the case of beer, carbohydrates into sugar in the fermentation process and so forth.
We had a question actually about the extreme beverages, and we should say we're referring to the combination of beer, wine, and mead, not like Four Loko or whatever in the ancient world. Paul in Dallas wants to know, because the source of your investigations is what was absorbed by the pot, is it possible the mixture of beer, wine, and mead was not a mixture, but that each was prepared and the same pot was used at different times?
That's a question I often get. In the case of the Midas tomb, we did analyses of residues from a whole series of different vessels, and we got very consistent chemical results from every vessel. So if you were using the same vessel over and over again for, you know, first for wine, then beer, then mead, you'd expect to see some more variation in the chemical composition, which we didn't see. So we assumed that it was a fermentation of all the ingredients as one. And, you know, then you get into questions of, you know, how do you do a single fermentation with these kinds of ingredients? I mean, do you take the whole beehive and toss it in because it has lots of extra nutrients? And, you know, we've experimented with, you know, ways that people could make these different beverages. One is with chewing, because we think one of the earliest ways that humans converted carbohydrates into sugar for making beer was they chewed it, because we have an enzyme in our saliva mm-hmm. that breaks down the carbohydrates into sugar. So we've done some experiments with especially corn chicha, and some of the listeners may have, you know, seen an article in the New York Times not too long ago. And if there's a program now on the Discovery Channel called Brewmasters, which again illustrates how they still use the chewing method in Peru to make this beverage. But that chewing operation, we have evidence for that going very far back all over the world. So that's a very common way that people made beer.
That sounds incredibly unpalatable. Have you been able to bring yourself to taste this?
I was one of the chewers.
Well, that's like if you're chewing your own, I suppose it's okay.
Yeah. Well, but yeah, that's the issue. Now you get it all mixed together, you know, but it goes through a boiling process, mm-hmm. so it's perfectly harmless.
Yeah. And then they would drink it through a straw?
Right. And in ancient times, again, sort of a worldwide phenomenon, is you use a straw or a long drinking tube to consume it. And the reason for that is you have a lot of gunk that comes to the surface. So you have yeast and leftovers of the grain or roots or whatever. And so you want to get down to the precious liquid below, so you use a long straw.
You also have, and I forget which culture it is, you discovered that they found a really innovative way of, there are little crystals that form, right, when beer is brewed.
Right, calcium oxalate or beer stone, mm-hmm. which if you make beer today, you get this white, whitish cast on the inside of the fermentation tank that is beer stone. And it's a kind of bitter, even poisonous substance, so you have to scrape it out, you know, between fermentations and clean it up.
And so what would they do to get rid of it before they had...
Well, one of the early examples of beer that we found, it was from Iran, of all places, you know, because you don't usually associate Iran with alcoholic beverages. But we found a vessel 5,000 years old, which had grooves on the inside of the vessel that were filled. It was filled with beer stone. Mm-hmm. And this would be another way to sort of collect that bitter substance.
So it settles there.
Yeah, it settles right into the grooves.
We have an email here from John who writes, wanted to know what you thought about champagne and beer found near Finland in a sunken ship. Would the beverages still taste good after sitting there for hundreds of years? Would the yeast still live in the beer under sea pressure for all that time?
I know about that discovery, and there's been a lot of ships found in the Baltic. You know, they had bottles of champagne, and the people, you know, have opened them up, say, you know, if it's like 1800, 1700, even underwater, as long as there's no penetration through the cork, it is okay. And you know, I would think even yeast would survive under those circumstances because they can, you know, unless the temperature were to go, you know, high and kill the yeast, they're sort of in a state of abeyance. So, you know, they're still viable, I think. But you know, once you get back to really early periods like the Egyptian wine that we were working on from the Scorpion tomb, you know, the yeast obviously breaks down. And we did identify yeast in those wine jars from Scorpion, which had, I think, 760 base pairs of the Saccharomyces. And we think it's like a precursor of the bread, wine, beer yeast.
Would the porosity of the clay vessels have affected the flavor? Did it go both ways, that the jar would absorb a little alcohol and the alcohol would absorb a little jar?
Yeah, I think that's something a lot of the experimental winemakers of today are exploring, like in Italy and Spain, France, is if you do your fermentation in the clay jars like ancient people did, you know, what are the sort of flavor profiles you get? I mean, usually now people put it into oak, but that's like adding a tree resin. Mm-hmm. Clay has its own properties. It can even have different tastes and so on. And recently I was in France down in the Côte area in the south, which the fellow, he does all of his fermentation in jars that he makes of local clay. And they had really distinctly different flavors. I'm not so sure at this point, you know, whether I really enjoyed those ones. But in other cases, like in Georgia, in the Caucasus I've been, again, you know, they do everything underground in large jars. And you get some really interesting development of flavors, quite different from the sort of standard wine that we have.
Do you find that everywhere you go in the world, people want you to taste their local alcoholic beverage and get your take on it?
Oh, yes. I mean, that's one of the nice side benefits of this exploring of the ancient world. You have to, you know, look at modern examples of fermented beverages to see what's possible.
How did this become your specialization?
Just by chance, really, because, you know, we started out looking at royal purple, which is this very expensive dye from antiquity.
From the snails?
The murex, yeah, the mollusks. And, you know, we saw that ancient organics could be preserved for a long time, 3,000 years in that case. And we then had someone come to us with a sample from Iran that was about 5,000-year-old sample. And since my colleague, who is an analytical chemist, had been brought up in the Pfalz area of Germany and his ancestors had been winemakers, he was very interested in getting involved and trying to figure out, you know, what the fingerprint compound for grape would be. I was interested because I had my first experience with grape picking on the Mosel River in Germany. And, you know, we just then dug in and figured out, you know, what techniques to use to try to identify a compound called tartaric acid, which is very specific for grapes.
Mm-hmm. And that's what ends up on the inside of a wine barrel, right?
Right, right.
Is there an unanswered question that still keeps you working?
There's always, you know, alcohols, these beverages are so, you know, much a part of human culture, you know, throughout time, that there's like an infinite number of questions that keep coming up and trying to figure out. So now we're working on how to the wine culture of the Near East get transferred across the Mediterranean and ultimately got established in France. And so we're looking at a site in southern France near Montpellier where we have Etruscan influence, and we have another site to the west that has more Phoenician influence, and we're at about 600 BC. And that's when wine came to France.
Patrick E. McGovern is Scientific Director of the Biomolecular Archaeology Laboratory for Cuisine, Fermented Beverages, and Health at the University of Pennsylvania Museum. His latest book is Uncorking the Past, The Quest for Wine, Beer, and Other Alcoholic Beverages. Tonight, he will deliver the Beauchel Family Lecture at the DMA. You can find ticket information online. Pat, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Well, that was a very quick hour. Are you sure it's over?
Good. I'm glad you think so. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening,
thank you.
And have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.